three ball from CG43. They're in front.
This is flat out ridiculous.
From a beautiful left hand, in and out finish, the old fashioned way.
Newell gets to the basket with one to come. From there again. You have got to be kidding me. Tyson Stiff.
Welcome back to the podcast, everyone. This episode is a departure from Andrew's Blitz Diary, which was great, but today we are back to the roots of this podcast. We're going to where sports and books and media intersect. Paul Shirley is a name you'll recognize. He's been on the show before, and if you know the NBA, Paul has written a book, another one. I want to say his fourth, certainly the fourth book that we've discussed on this podcast. This most recent book is called The Product is the Process. It's about finding and falling in love with the methodology needed to complete any and all of your goals. It's a great read. I read it. I enjoyed it. The book is only a tenner, $10. Buy it via the link in the description. You will get $10 of value out of the book, maybe even more. I guarantee it. In the beginning of this chat, we branch away from the book to discuss Paul's interactions with Robert Sarver, the recently embattled owner of the Phoenix Suns, for whom Paul worked for during his time in the NBA. I pose the question, did Sarver ever expose himself, reveal his penis after Paul signed his NBA contract? You'll find out yes or no. Enjoy this, and by the way, become a patron. Paul Shirley, he's back on the program. I think this is Paul's second or third time on the program. He's written a book. Paul, let's jump straight into it. You've written a book called The Process is the Product. Give people the elevator pitch.
So, as you know, I played professional basketball for a long time, and then I got into writing. And at some point, I realized that the process for both of those is really the same. It's about creating systems and habits and rituals and routines. And so that gave me the confidence to have the gall to write a semi-self-help book about how to achieve big projects and big goals. And that's the idea. Like, if you can figure out how to fall in love with the process, then you will eventually achieve that big goal. How'd I do?
Brilliant. I think both in the elevator pitch, you also threw out there the target audience. So I'm assuming it's for people who have a project in mind, or even not even that big of an aspiration. I'll put it to you. Who would be the target audience?
Some of it's work, right? Some of it's creative. But I think what is important to note is that there's been this quiet revolution in how we do work that people maybe weren't aware of. But if they note it, it starts to dawn on you that this is how everything is. What I mean by that is, let's say 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s, most jobs were process-based. You would go to work for Goodyear near my town of Topeka, Kansas, where I grew up, and you would stand there and do the same thing over and over. So they taught you a process. Well, now most jobs are actually project-based, not all, but most, where someone says, I need this done from you in 5 days or 5 weeks or 5 months, whatever it is. The problem is, we don't teach people how to build processes. We kind of assume that the job will do that for them. And so I think a lot of people are kind of wandering around like, man, I need to accomplish this long-term project, but I don't know how. So we've actually gotten into, with the company that I now run, working with companies around these ideas. So helping their staffs build systems so that they can accomplish big projects. This is all, of course, exacerbated by work from home and just a disconnect as well from people's sense of meaning at their job. So that's where we're headed. And what is exciting about it to me is that when you see the light go on for people, it really goes on, and they get that same feeling that I had when I was playing sports, when I'm writing books, that sense of like, oh, I can do this and I'm making actual progress.
We spoke about it when you wrote your last book, Ball Boy, but I'd be remiss if I didn't. The financials. How is this thing selling? How is it enriching your life, maybe beyond financials?
Do you mean the book or the business?
The book.
The book process doesn't sell at all. But it makes for a good calling card or business card. I almost wrote it knowing that it would be a really hard book to sell. And strangely enough, you know, since we last talked, Ball Boy has actually sold a fair number of books, not in any way, like in any kind of astronomical way, but it has found its stride, which is weird, but cool, and is kind of the very personification of what I talk about, right? Of falling in love with that day to day and forgetting about what the end result is, which is how I felt about that piece of fiction coming out. And which is how I feel about the processes of the product, this newest book, which means that I'm free to kind of write what I want and then see, does that resonate with people?
We're going to talk about that book. But before we do, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask this. Robert Sarver, I know your touch with the NBA is probably not what it was many years ago, but Robert Sarver, owner of the Phoenix Suns, a team you played for, has been found to be highly inappropriate in the workplace and fined $10 million and is now suffering a year's suspension from the NBA. When you signed your contract with the Suns in, I want to say, 2004, did he expose his penis to celebrate?
It wasn't that he exposed it. He was already naked when I got there, so he didn't have to take it out. It was just...
That's NBA standard, industry standard, though.
Industry, I mean, every owner. That's what this is expected of them. I don't really. I think at some point I wrote about how, he didn't strike me as a particularly humble or down to earth guy, and I was frustrated. Because one of the first meetings I was ever in with Phoenix was he had just bought the team and he was explaining to us what a financial wizard he was, but he kind of glossed over the fact that his mother, I think, had like given him $1 million to go buy a bank or something. So it was very, in baseball, American baseball terms, we would say he was born on third, but thought he hit a triple. So like he just
bunted at home. He didn't home run. He just got lucky in ground. Stadium.
With that said, he was annoying, and I didn't necessarily love him, but I didn't see anything that would give any indication. In fact, the person who wrote the big takedown of him got in touch with me because he was in LA, and he's like, I want to talk to you about. Yeah, about Robert Sarver, and I'm like, sorry, man, I don't have any goods on him. He seemed like a pretty stereotypical annoying rich guy, but I never saw anything that was untoward.
My last question on that is: can workplace health and safety advocates ever have a hope of making the NBA a safe workplace for women and the LGBT community? Amongst others, I mean, you've got owners who have just got super money and therefore presumably detachment. And then you've written about in your book, Can I Keep My Jersey? The players are on a different wavelength as well. It's a workplace that is, this is not an office in an accounting firm. It is a bizarre workplace. Can it ever hope to have normalcy?
Well, I think it's actually pretty sterile and boring now. And that was true even when I played. I don't think it's probably part of the reason I can't stand watching the NBA is because it's so sterile and it's extremely woke. The whole attitude around the NBA is a lot more about being politically correct than it is about toughness and resilience, which are the things that people actually care about with sports. And at some point that will haunt them. And I think it already does. Most average people here in the US would much prefer to watch American football because the NBA is looked at as a political organization in a lot of ways.
Really? I mean, I can speak for myself and friends I know. I just find it such an immature product. The players are all real young. It's got a young vibe. The ball just kind of rolls around. Even watching, I don't watch American football closely, but I can see that, oh, wow, this has stakes. These players care. They're colliding into each other. This is brutal and tough. And as you say, resilience and
toughness. Whereas the NBA, it's just roll out the balls, no contact, no defense, or don't get hurt, don't do this, take games off. That to me is irritating.
Well, I think the NBA has really benefited from short attention spans in that basketball lends itself to highlight reels. And so I think it has a position in the zeitgeist, in the popular consciousness, because it has benefited from TikTok and Instagram and Twitter, whereas other sports don't play quite as well in that regard. The problem is that there is an erosion over time that will happen when people think to themselves, but why would I go to the game? The core of all sports, you have to get people to go to the games and become dedicated to it. And that's what American baseball actually does really well. That's what college football in America does really well. That's what college basketball does in America really well.
Yes.
But the NBA it's so diluted, as you said, from an effort perspective, from a
schedule,
perspective. Yeah, there are too many games, and there are too many just bad teams that no one really cares about. The geography of it has gotten a little confusing to people, which, you know, that settles out with time as long as you have some patience. But if you ask the average fan, the average sports fan, is there an NBA team in Charlotte and where are they called? They would not know the answer. Is there an NBA team in New Orleans and what are they called? They would not know the answer. And that's not good for your sport. There are no sports fans who do not know what the American football team's names are.
That's a good place to leave the NBA. Let's come back to books, and in particular this one, The Process. I sent you this question in the week. You've just written, before this book, you wrote Ball Boy, which for me was about civic responsibility and the process of that, and the idea that you look at what your community wants and find reward in serving your community, even if it's perhaps not physically rewarded. And now you've written The Process, which helps people in a different way. I wanted to talk to you about imparting life lessons in fiction as opposed to nonfiction. What was the process to doing that, and how did it make you feel? And you know what I mean?
I think in nonfiction, it's of course going to be more overt. And the challenge with that is that people don't like being told what to do. So the task is, how do I frame this in a way such that we are looking at these experiences I've had together and then hopefully taking something away from them, which is actually where these two start to bleed together, in that really in fiction, you do want to get something across, a point or a message. It may not be a noble message. It may just be like, oh, the world is chaotic and terrible. Maybe that's your message. But the great thing about fiction is that you're able to hide as the puppeteer a little bit, and then have the audience look at a story with you, as opposed to having you megaphone it into their ears, which can be true of nonfiction. I mean, I think the best nonfiction gets its point across through stories and through history and stuff like that. But that's the challenge, and that's part of why The Process is the product is so short. It's only 25,000 words long, which is not very long for a book. Because I don't love reading stuff that's self-help related, where it just goes on and on. My goal was to do it and then get out. Whereas with fiction, there are, as your listeners may know, in TV writing and in film writing, there are such things as the A plot, the B plot, the C plot. So those are different storylines within a larger tale. And that's true of fiction too, right? Like when I was working on Ball Boy, the novel that you mentioned, there is of course Gray Taylor trying to fit into a new town. That's kind of the overarching plot. But then there's also, will Gray Taylor get the girl? Will Gray Taylor's mother be able to fit in the town? Will the football coach be able to talk the town into building him a new stadium? So there are all of these plots that are hopefully interweaved in a way that is entertaining to the reader and feels like real life, while you're also trying to get across some kind of sensation message, maybe. I mean, I think fiction is also fascinating because sometimes you don't start out trying to have a message. It just sort of seeps out as you're right. working on something, which is also what's really cool about fiction. My next book is also fiction. It's about a rock band. And that'll be, we're actually just seeing covers today, which is really cool. That will be out in probably the spring of next year. And similarly, like there were things that just started to come up that just started to gurgle up that were most likely a product of what I was seeing in the world and less a product of me declaring, this is what I want to say.
The physical process of writing both, I'm assuming you kept to a certain schedule, but when you had, did you sort of plan out it, both books where you're like, okay, this the process, did you write a flow chart for the process and a flow chart for Ball Boy, or did you have a very different physical nuts and bolts writing style for both?
Yeah, that's an astute question because nonfiction tends to lend itself to a bit more outlining, a bit more planning. Mm-hmm. The experiences I've had with fiction where I tried to plan it out, those books turned out to be terrible because I often then was telegraphing to the reader what was going to happen. With nonfiction, you do want to do some telegraphing. In the same way that if you were standing up in front of a crowd giving a presentation and you went up there and said, I want to talk to you guys about focus today. But then 3 minutes in, you said, but actually I want to talk to you about bourbon. They'd be like, wait, what? So there needs to be some level of through line in that regard. With fiction, you can do a lot more surprising people, but to surprise the audience, the author needs to be able to surprise themselves. And so what I've come to, and this is Paul's sort of main thesis on writing fiction, is that fiction is so much about creating really depthful characters, putting them in adverse situations and seeing what they do. And therefore it becomes an odd task of just transcribing what those characters would do based on how well you know them, in the same way that I might transcribe what happened between you and a wife or girlfriend or friend or whatever. It's so strange, but fiction becomes transcription. Even though these are made up characters, if you get to know them really well, you're like, well, of course that's what he would do in that situation. So therefore I just need to report on that. Does that make sense?
It does indeed. I think I've seen Stephen King in concert and he says that's what he does. He just sits, he writes characters and gets to know characters, writes them into a problem and writes them back out of it again. So I think that's pretty similar. I want to talk about this. Ryan Holiday, I think, is a guy we both admire. He does the Stoicism stuff. Mm-hmm. He wields the notoriety of the Stoics to give his work credibility. You've got Scott Webman in your corner. Not quite Aristophanes or Epictetus. Still not putting down Scott at all. I'm sure he'll get the credit he deserves and on that level. Are you nervous about such a front-facing book? And I'm not, not calling Ryan Holiday a coward by any means, but he wields that behind him. You're front-facing. How do you, does it make you nervous?
Do you mean front-facing in that it's more my experiences?
It's all your story out there. Again, and that's what's driving, like, hey, you should subscribe to the process. I did, and here's my results. Whereas Brian Holiday would say, oh, look, Marcus Aurelius said this. He was emperor of Rome,
Yeah. Well, that's what I fall back on as even more credibility, right? That I can be vulnerable and tell you the ways that I've screwed things up while also hopefully inspiring people by relating how I overcame those screw ups and succeeded in ways that are manageable and approachable. I do think that one of my problems with a lot of the habits books and self-help books is that the person hasn't actually done it. If it's kind of the age old, like, if you're so good at talking about business, then why don't you go start a business? And I feel that way about a lot of these people, mostly guys. So I was going to say guys, but it is guys. There's this preacher tendency to it that feels, it's not, inauthentic is maybe the wrong word, but it feels a little inauthentic because, again, I just want to say, like, well, how, did you live this or are you just studying it? Because I don't really care that much about what you've studied. Anybody could study it. If you can put it into practice, that's what I'm interested in.
Let's go with this. Self-criticism. So you've put out the book. If you were to put yourself in the mind of a critic, or perhaps in writing it, did you ever put yourself in the mind of a critic and say, if I was reading this as a skeptical person, how would I tear this down? What would be, is there any part of the book where you're like, oh, that's a bit of a soft white underbelly. I wish I could go back and improve that or anything like that. Do you have any criticisms of the process itself?
That I like that question. I would say that it was the best book I could write at the time. So it is difficult to, for me to criticize in that I once got to interview this band when I wrote for ESPN about music. And I asked the guy what I thought was a good question, which was, you're obviously more technically proficient now than you were 10 years ago. So do you ever look back at your old albums and think, God, that was a good idea that I just couldn't quite execute. I wish I had waited on that idea. And he paused and said, not really. I look at all of my albums like you would look at a photo album, in that that was a snapshot of what I could accomplish at the time. So I look at each of these books in a similar way. I'm sure I will write more and more about creating systems and those sorts of things. This was my first foray into pulling off something like self-help. So it's going to be flawed inherently 5 years from now. But for now, it's so recent in my mind that it still feels really current. There are things that, there are other ways into it. I start the book talking about people being distracted a lot. And there's an author named Johan Hari who has written a really cool book called Stolen Focus about how distracted we all are. And he did some stuff in there that I really liked that I thought, oh man, I wish I had thought of that. But his book, you know, came out after mine, and his book, he's also a, you know, New York Times bestseller. So he has access also to more time and freedom to go. In his book, he talks about like moving to Rhode Island for 3 months and just going off the grid. Well, I don't have the luxury of being able to do that. And so I needed to write a book from my perspective, which was, as we sort of mentioned earlier, it's less theoretical and more experiential. Here's what I've lived and learned. And I hope that you, the reader, will come along for that ride. So that's probably a long way around to a bit of a non-answer. But it does feel like I thought really hard about what I don't like about that genre of book and wanted to do something that I felt like I would want to read. And so that makes me happy with it because it would be something that if I picked it up, I'd be like, yeah, okay. He got in and got out and told some stories and made a point.
I don't think anyone could criticize the book for not doing that. It's lovely. It's nice and brief, fits in the back of your pocket, or at least I'm assuming it would. I had a Kindle version of it, which is never a good way to read a book, but it still carries on through.
I will mention that I have recorded the audio version of it, and that will come out both as an audiobook, but also as a podcast. And I honestly think that will be the best way to consume it.
I would agree.
So I'm pretty excited about that just because I don't know that, again, it's not like, oh, I'm going to sell a million copies of the audiobook or that it's going to get a million podcast downloads. But just from a consumability standpoint, I had in mind all along that it would make for a really good audio experience. So stay tuned for that. That'll happen in October or November. And I think we'll be a good way in.
It's funny to say that about an audio stuff. And I believe that as well, where there's not the same, this is not 1920. Buying books is just not, it's not a great consumer pathway to walk is what I'll say. Whereas scrolling up and down, if you type in, say, I wouldn't say this is a self-help, but, you know, attention helping procedural help into an Apple podcast search. And then you scroll through logos and see your gears working together with the process, and it's orange and it's white. That is something that a lot of people, I think, will click on. So when you say from a consumer standpoint, that's a much better consumer pathway to walk. So I think that'll go well. I want to have this question. We talked about the NBA at the top a little bit, but it's sort of funny that your basketball career is the personification of your theory and the process, that the process is the product. Your journey was better or more enjoyable or more fulfilling than the destination. In your book, Can I Keep My Jersey? You got to the NBA and found it richly unfulfilling. I hope I'm not speaking for you, but as I said, now I think your playing days are seemingly a totally disinterested and disappointed. You were disappointed by the NBA. However, in this book, you didn't really spend the time, and maybe you didn't want to, spend the time criticizing the NBA. You never said the simple thing of like, I tried so hard to make the NBA, got there, got pounded in the liver, it was horrible, and was only there for a short time. The Suns was a fun season, and that was it. Yeah, you didn't really slag off the NBA in the book. Was that a holistic choice on your part where you didn't want to go down into that kind of negativity or not?
Another fine question by you. Well done. I would say and also shows that you actually paid attention, which I am just so grateful for. So thank you.
Welcome.
I think some of my writings in Can I Keep My Jersey were really immediate around and emotional around, like, oh, this isn't nearly what I thought it would be. Some of what has benefited me about being in the NBA has made it difficult for me to be as hard on getting to the NBA. What I mean by that is, even though I only played in, God, I don't know, 30 games in the NBA or something, or maybe less than that, I don't know. The fact that I made it to the NBA has loomed larger and larger with time. And so even though I didn't love the day-to-day experience of it, I now value the fact that I persevered until I got to that height, because I think I would be disappointed, as I talk to you now, if I hadn't. Even though I would know deep down that it wouldn't matter all that much, I think it just, it does add some street credibility to my message, right? Like it maybe doesn't add, it definitely doesn't add as much street credibility as if I'd been a 9-time All-Star or something. But in my brain, because with time, all these stories get crunched and simplified, in my brain, I can still see the little boy I was shooting baskets on the gravel driveway of his parents' house when he was 12. And I can see me in the NBA. Even if I was not playing a ton, I was still in the NBA. And that direct, that linear path is pretty easy to visualize in my head. Like, well, I started here, I got here, and it was kind of a miracle that that happened. But wait, it wasn't really a miracle. It was more about like the diligence and perseverance along the way. So I think it helps to make my case for things like the process is the product. If I said in the book, I was a, you know, small town kid that nobody knew about, and I got to play in Europe, that would not quite have the impact as I made it to the NBA. So even though I didn't love it, it still now serves me in a different way that I think is helpful and has its own benefits.
Perfect. Paul, we've got 9.5 minutes left. I've got one question left for you. This has worked really well. Not so much a question, more an explainer. I don't know if you've got that countdown in front of you. So if you cut out, it's been really fun. I really liked your stop with surplus creativity. So if you're working on a project and you want to just work on it for 8-10 hours to exhaustion because you're just, oh, I'm writing this, it's fun. You say set an amount of time, stop, leave creativity in the tank so you can return to it the next day and the day after and the day after. I thought that was one of the things I really took from the book, and I hope people do the same.
And then the other thing is, and I hope this is from the process, because I did read it a while ago, but you said when you're starting a project or endeavoring on one, sit down and write down the one or two things or however many things, but the most biblically important things to that process. For example, if you're writing a script, write down this script may be about an intergalactic space battle, but the most important thing to me is the relationship between the brother and sister. And don't budge from that. So if it's like, oh, should they go to another planet and separate? No, it's about the relationship with the brothers. So keep that sacred. I really like those two things. With 8 minutes and 21 seconds left, what was something from the book that you even perhaps surprised yourself at and thought, oh, that's a really, you know, to toot your own horn, that was a good idea.
I like what you said about the leaving something in the tank. Yeah,
it's brilliant. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but people out there, it's a really, because I used to do this. You get onto a project, go to exhaustion, and then you realize you can't go back to it for a week, whereas you're better off doing an hour at a time. Sorry, Paul.
I think having to synthesize other people's material meant that I then understood even my own thoughts on all of this better, right? So I quote Stephen Pressfield, who talks in The War of Art about a lot of these same kinds of things, right? And that those are applicable not just to the creation of artistic projects, but also to the creation of a PowerPoint, or to building out an event that's in 6 weeks, or building a relationship with your husband or wife. So finding the universality through other sources that forced me to think about questions of flow and concentration and focus and achieving longer term goals, such that this book in many ways also serves as like a PhD thesis almost. Like I had to not only study myself, but also think about how other people have thought and written about this stuff in a way that means that I just feel a lot more facility in talking about these sorts of things in the business, right? So we have a physical space here in Denver. And so in addition to working with companies virtually and kind of all over the world, we do have a physical space here where people come and sit and work, and they set a goal for 45 minutes and then we check in with them afterward. And I can just tell that I'm better at this job because I wrote the book. So that's, you know, I hopefully that it means that there's an entertaining book in there. But I think for me personally, there's this excitement that it starts to feel a little bit like my basketball career did, where there were times early in any sports career where you are completely just making it up. You know, like, holy cow, I don't know what I'm doing here. I'm just trying to hold on. When I went to training camp with the Los Angeles Lakers, fresh out of college, I was just trying to not embarrass myself. But then not even 2 years later, I had a tryout for the Chicago Bulls in the middle of the season where it was me and three other guys. And I remember leaving that tryout thinking, oh man, I'm better than those guys now. And it wasn't like I'm three times better than them. It was more, I understand how the game works, both like in a literal sense, how the basketball game works, but I understand how the game of this tryout works and what I need to do. And that facility or faculty, whatever you want to call it, is almost like feeling like a wizard, where you can kind of tell the future. People now will talk to me about what they're doing with their habits and their routines or productivity or connection to their job. And I can kind of see what they're going to go through. Like, well, here they're going to get real excited because this is going to solve their problems for a little while. And then they're going to get frustrated because it's pretty unending. And then they'll make a decision at some point of like, well, this is either worth it or it's not. And that I don't want to get too far ahead of myself. I have a long way to go for understanding this stuff and being good at helping people, but it does feel really, I mean, it's exciting. I get off on it. Like it's in the same way that I got off on being a really good basketball player and having that sense of like, oh, this is like magic. I can do magic, but with a basketball. I'm starting to get that sense with the stuff that we're doing.
It's brilliant. And we talked about Ryan Holiday. Let's end him at the top. He says, or Epictetus says, you don't rise to the occasion, you rise to the level of your training. And that's what you described, your experience. Paul, I appreciate chatting as always. It was really good. People out there, the process, I paid a tenner for this book and I took away a couple of things from it, four or five things that have enriched my life beyond the $10 I paid for it. In a physical sense too, I've done things with it where I've thought, oh, you know, I'm going to set an hour to apply for that job and have since got it, which has paid me more than the tenner I paid for it. So it's made money. It's made me money in my lifetime, if that's what's really valuable to. It's made my life better in small ways where I'm more organized and less precious about stuff where I kind of just go, I'm giving that an hour of my time today. And you give it an hour and you walk away. So,
yeah, I mean, you mentioned that we only had 40 minutes to record this podcast. And I love that because it meant that we had to dial it in, right? We had to focus and decide this.
I had 12. Yeah. I cut it down.
Yeah.
And it was all the better for it.
Yeah. I love that about that. That is so much of what we're talking about is building these constraints, not to be rigid and a robot, but because the constraints are actively what leads to the creativity. Like us knowing we had a shorter time meant that we were focused and ready to go, as opposed to, well, we've got 2 hours.
Yeah, in the past,
we get kind of drowsy and soporific and uninteresting. So well done by you.
And likewise, Paul, pleasure.